So we've all heard of the study that was done a couple of years ago that says in the next 20 years, half of all the jobs that we do currently will be done by computers or robots or AI or whatever. Half of the jobs we're currently doing today will be gone, and we'll all be standing on the street corner looking at each other. Seems to be what we're being told. So don't ask for an increase in that minimum wage, and don't ask for wage increases or benefits or any of that stuff. Just be happy you have a job now. Which, you know, I got to tell you, I love that frame because, you know, it keeps people from not demanding a portion of the wealth that they create. And also keeps them grateful for having the job and having not been thrown to the curb already. But how bad is it going to be? How bad will be the future of AI? Will everyone be standing out on the street corner looking at each other? I don't know. That's why I've asked my good friend, Dr. Stephen Herzenberg, to come talk with us. He's the executive director of the Keystone Research Center, and they're working on a project right now to maybe talk about what that's going to look like. Steve, thanks for taking time for us.
Happy to, Rick.
So half the job's going to be gone, and we're all just going to be standing around with nothing to do except watch the robots work.
No, that's exaggerated, and that particular Oxford study is a little bit silly, but like with lots of things, in the end, we don't really know exactly how much artificial intelligence or robots, you know, how many jobs are they gonna?
They just kind of guessed. Okay,
yeah.
What about the fast food industry? Because we're told don't ask for that $15 in a union because hey, we've got Flippy the hamburger flipper, or we've got the kiosks that are going to be in every McDonald's in the next couple of years, and all those jobs will be gone, and kids won't have jobs anymore. Steve.
Yeah. No. So again, everyone's crystal ball is really foggy, right? So the guys at Oxford. Other academics, nobody really knows exactly the scale of these impacts or the time frame of these impacts. It is, you know, there are reasons to think that, I mean, artificial intelligence, which is computers get more and more powerful, and they now have what they call machine learning, where, you know, machines actually can teach themselves to be smarter. If you show them enough, like, pictures of you know, radiological exams of patients, right? And you show them a picture, and then you tell them what that diagnosis was, right? So they can actually draw a set of inferences if you throw them like hundreds of thousands of actual cases, right? The machines can, if you show them another one, they might do better than a typical radiologist. So there are a bunch of specific domains or specific kinds of jobs where people have a particular narrow set of responsibilities that machines over time are going to do more of the work. But the issue, as always, is how are we going to manage these changes, right? So, I mean, again, at one level, when machines do the work, that's not always bad, right? I mean, you know from the trucking industry, right? People talk a lot about driverless vehicles or automated vehicles, right? Well, for those folks who are driving 70 or 80 hours to earn $50,000 or $60,000 a year, enough to maintain their income and support their family, man, if you could have the automated vehicles do half of that work, and they could then work 35 hours a week and make, you know, the same 50 or 60 grand, then that'd be awesome, right?
That would be awesome. But what I do know, Steve, is if that were to happen and you did drop from 70 down to 35 and you were making 50, you're going to end up probably making 20 on the other side of it.
Well, so in the end, what we're really saying to each other is that, like always, distribution matters enormously. So a couple of basics here, which is some of the claims about how quickly technology is going to do all the work are silly. They're exaggerated. We've heard these before. Number two, some of these technologies are new, and so they might have a broader impact than some of the past technologies. So there are going to be impacts.
Right.
But again, the upside of those impacts is when machines do the work, it's called productivity growth. So again, that gets us to that third point, which is it's all about distribution. And
right.
So you and I both know that the last 40 years, distribution in the U.S. has been horrible. We keep getting richer and richer. Productivity keeps going up about, 2% a year every kind of 35 years or over the past 40 years. We've more than doubled how much each worker produces per hour of work. But basically, lots of workers haven't seen really a penny of that, right? So in the end, it's like if we're going to have machines doing lots of the work, it could be cause for celebration, could be higher incomes, could be shorter work time, could be more time with family, but if we do as badly as we've done in the last 40 years in terms of who gets the money, then it's going to be ugly, and we're going to have more inequality and, more rich people controlling our democracy because they have most of the wealth. And so, that's the issue. It's not about technology. Is not in the end going to determine technology by itself doesn't have good or bad effects. It's how we our political system, how we manage the impacts of technology.
Yeah, and look, I'm not a Luddite, but even me, I look at the scanner at the grocery store. I won't use it because I'm afraid that's going to put somebody out of work, because we're not doing well by people who are replaced by technology. We've got trade adjustment assistance where if someone loses their job because of a bad trade deal, we help them with education and wages to make sure that they can make it through their education process. But if technology, kicks you out on the curb, there's nothing. Sorry, progress just ran over you.
No, that's right. So again, the example you just gave in trade adjustment assistance was kind of invented when we started to lose manufacturing jobs.
Right.
Right. And it's all great to get 2 years of unemployment insurance or up to 2 years of training, but if the only jobs you can get pay only half as much as the manufacturing job you used to have, that sucks.
So what's the answer then?
Well, the answer is in the end politics and organizing. There's one tiny upside is that in these debates about technology, there are some folks, like Silicon Valley entrepreneurs with a conscience, who are actually worried about people being left without any paid work, right? Worried about the social consequences. So they're talking about everybody getting a certain amount of money regardless of whether they're working, right?
Right, guaranteed minimum incomes.
Yeah, what's called universal basic income. So again, there's at least a debate about should we, don't we need as a society, especially as we get richer and richer with the machines doing more and more of the work, don't we need to make sure everybody has some level of income, right?
Right.
So that's a debate.
Well, it's an old debate. I mean, you go back to Milton Friedman in the 70s and his idea of the negative tax. It's the exact same thing. And from his argument, it was, we need consumers. If you're going to make all this stuff, who's going to buy it?
Well, but no, that's fair, you're right, because again, it's already true that the top 1% gets 20% of the income and 40% of the wealth. And so, if you go up a lot from there, you're right. There's no middle class to consume things. But the good thing about that, in a way, is that even the businesses have an interest in the end.
Right.
Getting the distribution half decent. So, yeah, someone will buy their stuff.
So what would it be? I mean, let's say, for instance, we'll use what I know is the trucking industry. Let's say you take those long-haul truck drivers who are making 50 grand a year and you give them what? I mean, they're going to be out of a job. What do they end up with? I've heard people say, well, $1,000 a month, $1,500 a month guaranteed income.
Yeah, but
that's not going to replace 50 grand a year.
No, it's not. But again, in the end, that's not where I would go. I mean, universal basic income, maybe somewhere way down the road, but there are a bunch of other policies you could do. I mean, trucking, right? So there was a New York Times editorial this weekend, right, which talked about what's happened in trucking and the collapse of wages over the last 40 years. And, again, it's about things like the misclassification of drivers as independent contractors. It's also about drivers not being paid for all that time they're waiting for the next load.
Right.
So, I mean, again, we could use technology to we can track where drivers are now. It's a trivial. We actually have electronic. We're supposed to now not have hard copy books logging how many hours people drive and whether or not they're violating the rules about how many hours you can drive in a week.
No, no, the computer does an amazing job of tracking where you are, how fast you're going.
So we could use that information to say people have to be paid for even the hours that they're waiting for the next load, right?
But someone has to force them to do that. I mean,
well, no, that's right. So that's why it's back to politics and, you know, and organizing and unless progressive politicians, unless workers in unions, you know, they need to demand things like changes in the trucking industry or the things that are demanding now, like higher minimum wage or, there's another set of debates now about, to my mind, a better alternative than or more plausible alternative in the U.S. than, you know, universal basic income. So a certain amount of money, regardless of whether you work, would be some kind of public employment, you know, option, right? So like a return to the Roosevelt Civilian Conservation Corps, right?
Sure.
So in the great, so it's like, again, if you're worried now that there's not going to be enough market work, paid work from our market economy, then rather than having people starving and also people not using whatever talents and skills they have, can we put in place a public program that gives everybody the ability to a job and then an income linked with that job?
I mean, sure. No, look, I'm with you. I'm of the mindset that everyone needs a reason to get up in the morning, and I do believe in an honest day's work. I think there's therapeutic qualities to it. And I've always said, you know, for over a decade on this show, that if the private sector can't or won't create enough jobs, the public sector has to step in and guarantee something and be the employer of last resort. And in the IA frame, I think there should be a technology cost to where if you do get rid of that truck driver, you pay that salary until that person would have naturally retired and moved on into taxes so that they can then use that money to have a baseline to make sure that people don't go broke and aren't starving on the street corner.
Right. So we got to open up the debate with a whole range of ways you can spread the benefits of these kinds of technologies. I mean, there are now three presidential candidates, including Sanders, Cory Booker, I can't remember the third one, but who actually are supporting public employment options, things like the Civilian Conservation Corps. So again, that's a policy debate like universal basic income that nobody was talking about 5 years ago,
right?
But is now back on the screen partly because of these fears around technological displacement. So again, we've had since Reagan, the range of debate about what you're allowed to do to make the economy work better for regular people has been incredibly narrow, right? For the most part, we're supposed to all kneel down and pray to the market and
the invisible hand.
Yeah, all that, right. So again, the good news is, hey, when you've got suddenly people talking about public employment creation, you know, the right to a job is the language people use. When you got people talking about universal basic income, at least that's sort of an opening up to the debate. And it's, again, we gotta go through that door. It's the beginning of a conversation, which is like, in the end, policy should be guided by what kind of society do you want, right? I mean,
we don't want a bunch of lazy people with no opportunity. In fact, I just watched some woman read poorly on a Fox News clip. I forget what her name is, Trish Regan or something like that, where she was talking about, you know, if we go down this socialist path where you want to take us to where nobody works and everyone gets free education and free everything, there's no opportunity and there's no incentive, and it's just, we're going to be Venezuela. and it's going to be the end of America, and because we believe in entrepreneurship and we believe in opportunity and winners and not being losers.
Yeah, all right. So we got to win that argument with, again, I think more people now think that the rules are rigged against them, and they're
of course they
ready.
Are.
Well, okay, so this, I mean, this future of work debate, I still think, a betting person would say, just like with climate change, a betting person at this point, the U.S. and global response, but led by the U.S., to climate change has been nothing short of pathetic, right? So, so a betting person would say, if we do get, and we probably will ultimately, if we do get this new wave of technological change that does have machines doing a bunch of work that they couldn't do in the past, they won't. I don't think they'll be doing caregiving for the elderly. I don't think they'll be doing childcare for kids. Right? I mean, there are a bunch of things that involve that where people's ability to broad skills and understanding of context and, you know, machines still don't think the way people do.
Not yet.
I hope they don't.
I hope they never do.
And I think the person I trust on these issues the most who's working with me on this project makes very clear that machines, don't have certain skills people have. And again, it's like machines follow a set of rules. So,
right.
So the bottom line is you can, if you perfect the code for an automated truck to drive from Harrisburg to Pittsburgh, you can't then, you know, that AI is not going to be able to fly a plane or figure out whether or not somebody's stolen a credit card or, right? I mean, right. So these technologies can play Go, they can play chess. Right, I mean, they can do things in specific areas.
Sure.
But what people are fantastic at is, I mean, one particular example that my friend John gives is actually people. Most people have never seen a deer, right? When they're driving on a highway, they've never seen a deer jump in front of them. But actually, most people, if they see a deer, will know what it is, and will sort of know how to react, and maybe they'll get it right, maybe the reflexes aren't good enough. But actually, machines can't do that.
Right.
I mean, machines, the truck can avoid the deer because you've shown it lots of deer, you know, or you've shown it the kid running into the street after a soccer ball, right? So again, the way the machines do it now is still... is still different than the way we do it. Which
sure.
Again, if a
deer jumps out in front of me, I'm going to run into it. If a kid runs out in front of me, I'm going to try and avoid it.
Well, okay, and it depends how far the deer is, and you'll make it. Actually, people will make, even if you've never done this before, you'll actually make a judgment about whether.
I've done it before. In fact, I hit one deer, and six more hit me. One came, and behind it were a whole bunch more.
Right. But part of what I am saying is, again, that machines are incredibly powerful and computers are more powerful with every single year. But the human brain is this miraculous thing.
You're right. And to highlight your point, and I think maybe a little bit better example, is a friend of mine explained that in Japan, there's a 72-room hotel.
Okay.
And it has five people who work there.
Okay.
Everything else is done by automation. The rooms are cleaned automatically. The bathrooms are self-sanitizing. Everything is done by computer, or you check in with a computer animation thing.
Right.
Like you'd go to one of the poker screens at the casino. The only time you deal with an actual human being is when there's a problem, when there's a complex problem that a machine isn't going to be able to answer.
Right.
My problem, though, is look, there's a hotel here with 72 rooms that probably at one point would have employed 30 to 40 people, now just five. That's where my problem becomes. And you're right. People are never, I don't think, ever going to be completely outdated or useless. but there'll be fewer of us needed. And that's where I think a lot of people who have diminished skills or, you know, aren't going to go back to school in their 50s to get a crummy job. I think that's where the concern is.
That's fine. But I also think it's up to us. It's up to our side to sort of lift up the positive possibilities. Like, I mean, again, in addition to higher income, because machines can suddenly do all this work.
Right.
The other part of it is shorter work time.
No, I'm with you. I mean, look, labor should have been pushing, you know, back in the 50s, they were pushing for a 24-hour work week.
Yeah. And again, my reading of history is partly that organizing and political success are partly driven by possibility. So people rallied around the New Deal because they were desperate and starving, but also because they thought that, you know, organizing unions that could lift workers' wages, having a minimum wage, having unemployment insurance so that the people without a job could spend something, having Social Security so that old people could spend something, right? There was a set of ideas then that, you know, people were both in pain but also knew or thought that there might be a way out of this that Roosevelt has articulated, right?
Right.
So, again, it's like... to me, part of our messaging has got to be, hey, again, if machines are going to do a whole bunch of the work, and a lot of the work is work that people don't necessarily want to do. I mean, it's not all like deep pit coal mining or rote factory jobs where, again, as long as people aren't going to be left starving, people don't necessarily want those jobs. So some of the machines are going to do some routine accounting work, routine legal work, routine medical work, you know, that's actually fairly well paid and fairly, quote, highly skilled. But still, a lot of the machines are more likely still to be doing the stuff that nobody would really rather do, except that it's the only way they could put food on the table.
Yeah.
Right. And so again, it's back to, we need to paint a positive and practical picture of, you know, the AI economy for all that we could have. And then, you know, we need to create it in Seattle and San Francisco and Boston.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. And I'm looking forward to this happening because, look, we're not going to stop it. And this is where I try and explain to people, you know, you're not going to stop. The ball's already rolling down the hill. Right. It's a matter of how we manage that ball rolling down the hill.
Right. And if we let, I mean, again, the right and the neoliberals are all set with their story about even more of the money going to a tiny fraction of the top. It's because they're the ones with all the ideas, right? They're the ones that generated this technology. They're just getting their just reward.
Yeah, they're the producers. They're the producers.
Yeah, and that's right. That's right. And so the people without a job, the parasites, you know, the people with no skills. Yeah, it's just unfortunate, but that's just, you know. The economy works by giving people the rewards they deserve, right? And that's, I mean, again, that's a complete pile of nonsense. I mean, all of these technologies are built on a foundation of public investment,
yep.
Right? I mean, the internet comes from U.S. Defense spending more than anything else. Right.
Yeah, and I've had someone tell me all the things that came out of NASA. Public investment, you know, has done wonders for the private sector. I just think a lot of people are a little worried, and I'm one of them who's a little bit worried as well. But this is a fascinating topic. I would love to pick this up again another time because this isn't going away, and I'd love to hear what comes out of your project, the report, and what kind of response you got.
Cool. Happy to come back.
Good stuff. Steve, I appreciate the time. Always good talking with you.
All right. Take care.
Our good friend, Dr. Stephen Herzenberg, executive director there of the Keystone Research Center. Interesting and good stuff. Quick break, right back to wrap things up. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm the talk.